We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
About $600 billion into the system, which mostly stayed with the banks. But psychologically, this stimulus got the markets excited just to see someone do something. And the problem is the economy has gotten to the point where basically the Federal Reserve is the last institution that can act. People don't trust the president or Congress. That leaves the Federal Reserve. And so everyone's watching to see what they're going to do.
That's NPR's Robert Smith in New York. The public is getting its first look today at the new memorial to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in the nation's capital. NPR's Paul Brown says it features a 30-foot-tall granite sculpture of the slain civil rights leader.
He faces the tidal basin in Washington and looks across toward the Jefferson Memorial. Large crowds expected today, lots of chairs set up.
That's NPR's Paul Brown at the King Memorial. Checking Wall Street, the Dow is currently up 88 points. The NASDAQ is up 22. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, whose Kids Count report provides state-level data on the well-being of kids and families at aecf.org.
WILL programs are made possible by the Farmers Market on historic North 1st Street in Champaign, Thursdays from 3 to 7 p.m. The North 1st Street Farmers Market accepts link cards and features locally grown produce and meat, crafts by local artisans, cooking demonstrations, and family-friendly activities.
Michael Hogan has been president of the University of Illinois for a little more than a year. He came to Urbana at a time when the state was facing a fiscal crisis and many wondered whether the university could remain both competitive and affordable. I'm David Inge. On Tuesday, August 23rd, I'll talk with Michael Hogan about some of the challenges of his first year and invite your questions on a range of issues, including changes in administration and the effort to streamline operations. That's a conversation with Michael Hogan Tuesday, August 23rd at 9 p.m. on WILL TV, AM, and online. And this is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, I'm sorry to say we weren't able to make contact with Edward Girardet, the journalist who we had scheduled for the first hour. We were going to talk with him about some of his experiences over many years reporting from Afghanistan. Perhaps we can have that scheduled for another day. Instead, we'll go to the archives for a program. I do want to mention, though, that we will be here live hour number two, talking about the care of the back, and our guest will be Dr. James Harms. He's an orthopedic surgeon with Carl. So we will be live, and we will take questions. So for the first hour, we'll go to the Focus archives. We'll be reaching back a couple of years for a program we first broadcast in 2009. So for this first hour, do keep in mind we will not take calls. John Charles Gilkey is a man who loves books. He loves them so much that he was willing to break the law to get them. And he is not alone. International rare book theft is reported to be more widespread than fine art theft. Now, unlike most thieves, Gilkey didn't steal the books to resell them and make money. He stole them to add to his growing personal collection. This morning, in this hour of the show, we will explore the romance of books and also the temptation to steal them, which is the subject of a book that is just coming out. The title of the book is The Man Who Loved Books Too Much, The True Story of a Thief, a Detective, and a World of Literary Obsession. Riverhead Books is the publisher. And the author is our guest for this hour of the show, Allison Hoover Bartlett. She's written on a variety of topics, including travel, art, science, and education. And she's written for The New York Times, Washington Post, Salon.com, San Francisco Chronicle Magazine, San Francisco Magazine, other publications. Her original article on John Gilkey was included in the Best American Crime Reporting 2007. She's a founding member of the writing group North 24th, and she also works at the San Francisco Writers Grotto, which is a collective studio, and she lives in San Francisco. She's talking with us by telephone. Ms. Bartlett, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I appreciate you doing this. I think, actually, the book is not even officially out yet.
That's right. It's out day after tomorrow.
Thursday. And I know that you'll be traveling around and talking about the book.
That's
so,
right.
I think this will be a big book in the sense that a lot of people will be interested in it and will like it. And I think if you think of yourself as a book lover, I think you'll be attracted to this story.
I hope so.
Just to start, there's an interesting story here that you tell in the book about how you got interested in the whole subject of book theft. And it has to do with the fact that a book, an old book that strolled away from a library, came into your possession. Tell that story.
Well, I was visiting this friend of mine named Malcolm, and sadly, his brother had committed suicide several months earlier. But among his belongings was this ancient book that my friend Malcolm was about to show me. It was a book published in Germany in 1630, a botanical book with medicinal remedies. So if you happen to be suffering from the plague, for example, which was sweeping through Germany at that time, you would refer to this book for remedies for the symptoms, to treat the symptoms. So with this book, though, came a note, and the note from Malcolm's brother said that a friend of his had checked it out from a college library, forgot to return it. He hadn't got around to it and asked the reader of the note to please return the book anonymously. Well, when Malcolm pulled this gorgeous old book out of this linen sack that it was in, I thought it was really the most beautiful book I had ever seen. But my second thought was, it's got to be stolen. Who can check a book like that out of the library? It looked like a prop from a Harry Potter movie. It was big. I think it weighed 12 pounds. I weighed it at one point. It had these brass clasps on the side to affix it shut and hand-painted illustrations throughout. Anyway, I left Malcolm's house that day thinking about this book, and I knew nothing about the rare book world at that time, but I wanted to find out if I could discover if the story in the note was true, if not, who it belonged to, and so on. So I thought about it all evening. I woke up, I was still thinking about it the next day, so I thought, I'm going to do some work on this. And I went to the internet and typed something like stolen rare books. And I have to say, for a writer who's always on the lookout for a good story, this was like opening a treasure chest. There was just one story after another about rare book theft. Some of them had occurred months ago, some weeks earlier. But among all of those stories, the ones that interested me most were the thieves who stole out of a love for the books. And they make up the minority of thieves, I should say. Most people who steal rare books are like jewel thieves or car thieves. They want to sell the goods and make a lot of money and move on to the next theft. So I was interested in the others, those who stole out of love. The one story that really caught my eye was about John Gilkey, who happened to be the most prolific rare book thief in recent years. And I found his story in a newsletter piece. It was in an Antiquarian Booksellers Association newsletter. And the man who had written it was named Ken Sanders. He was a dealer in Salt Lake City who had spent 3 years tracking down Gilkey and helping to catch him. So I contacted Ken Sanders, the dealer, and asked him if he would tell me his story, and he would. And I also asked him if he knew how I could possibly find this thief, John Gilkey. And he said, oh, I have no idea. He served a sentence at San Quentin, and I believe he was released a few months ago. And if you ever find him, I doubt he'll even talk to you because he denied having stolen the books in court. So I called San Quentin and discovered that indeed, as Sanders had told me, Gilkey had served his time and had been released a few months before then. But a few more calls that I made, I learned that he was again arrested for stealing books and was back in prison, this time in Tracy, California, which is about an hour east of San Francisco. So I wrote Gilkey in prison and asked him if he would possibly talk to me and tell me his story, and I waited for weeks for an answer. I checked my mailbox once, sometimes twice a day, and eventually got what I was hoping for, which was a letter from Gilkey saying that he would tell me his story. And so our first meeting was actually in prison, and we continued to meet over the next few years, both in prison and out, as he went back and forth.
Yeah, and I guess one of the things that's maybe a little bit surprising, given the fact that he denied having... He said in court that he was not guilty. He seemed perfectly willing to talk with you about what he had done.
Yes, that was one of the big surprises in this process. He opened up literally immediately when I went to prison, and we were in one of those booths, you know, separated by plexiglass with a telephone receiver to talk through. And I introduced myself, he introduced himself, and the first thing he said was, "So do you want me to tell you how I got my first book?" And he went on to tell his story, and I think he seemed eager to share it. I think most of us like sharing our stories with others, but he doesn't know a lot of book collectors. I don't think he's friendly with any book collectors, in fact, and so I think it was an opportunity for him to share information he had about books and his, share his love for books with somebody who understood that part of his motivation.
Yeah. Very quickly, again, let me introduce the guest, Allison Hoover Bartlett. She has told you here a little bit of the story of her new book that is going to be out officially on Thursday, The Man Who Loved Books Too Much. And it is about the theft of rare books, and one man in particular who was very prolific, a thief of rare books. It's published by Riverhead Books. And I do also want to mention that if people go to your website, AllisonHooverBartlett.com, they can actually see the book, this German book that you talked about as the thing that started you into the story. They can look at it and see what it looks like and see what a few of the pages inside look like. And it does look extremely cool. Even if you couldn't read German, I could see the appeal of a book like that, why you would think you would like to have it, or if it came into your hands, you'd decide you'd like to hold on to it.
Yes, in fact, when my friend agreed to let me borrow it for a while so that I could do some research on the book, I ended up holding on to it, I think, for 2 years. It was hard to let go, but I think that's what happens with books. Mm-hmm. People fall in love with them, whether it's their childhood favorites or something like this. We have strong attachments to books, and for book collectors, that attachment is much stronger.
And that's the kind of thing that, though, I'd say for myself, I like books very much, and there are quite a few of them in my house, and I like to read. But the level of obsession, passion, whatever word you want to use, seems, to me, at least maybe a little hard to understand.
Yeah, when I first started doing research on the book, I would ask not just John Gilkey, of course, but any collector I met or dealer, why they collected books. And the answer almost always started out with, "Well, I don't know," or "I'm not sure." And it's not exactly clear to them. I also consider myself a book lover, but I'm not a collector, and I wanted to find out what that was about. And I think, it's a complex answer, but that love of books that we all share, that we associate fond memories with the childhood books, maybe with our favorite college books, and with every phase of our life we have some favorites. But I think with the collector, what happens is that love of books is mixed with a deep appreciation for the book as an aesthetic object, and as something that represents a certain history, whether it's of the history of golf or the history of the Renaissance or whatever that particular collector's interest is. And what happens is this, I think, as they begin accumulating those books that they love, it grows into a kind of obsession, so that the more that they have, the more they want. And I think this is probably true of any collector, not just book collectors.
Mm-hmm. It also seems, at least based on the people that you talk about in the book, that this is very much a male pursuit.
It is, and that was another question that was hard to answer. Traditionally, of course, men have had the money and the freedom to pursue pastimes like this. It takes a lot of money to grow a large book collection. Although there are many collectors who collect books that are worth maybe a couple of $100s, not thousands and thousands. But it used to be that it was just something that the wealthy did, and men were the ones with the money. Now, though, I think that is changing. I spoke with a dealer in Maine who's a woman, and she sees more and more women beginning to collect. And, in fact, I went to a rare book fair in San Francisco, and I would advise any book enthusiasts out there to visit one of these fairs. The first time I went, which was while I was working on this book, I was just astounded by what I saw, and the books that you can hold that you would expect to see in a museum. Anyways, at this San Francisco book fair, there was a course that you could attend, a free class, something like Book Collecting 101, for people who just wanted to get into it and wanted to learn a little bit more. And the vast majority of people attending that class were women.
Hmm. I mentioned the fact that it's been estimated that the theft of rare books is bigger than the theft of fine art, and that, as also as you mentioned, a lot of people who do this, the thieves, they're stealing the books to resell them and make money. You also pose this question in the book, well, if this is so big, why don't we hear more about it? And it seems that the answer is that rare book dealers and the librarians who oversee rare book collections, they don't want to talk about it.
That's right. That's something that's been the practice for centuries. Because, of course, rare book theft has been around as long as books have been around. People in the early days were pilfering the most select items, even if they weren't considered rare yet. The problem is that among dealers, they don't want to let the public know that they've lost a book, that a book has been stolen from them, because collectors often entrust them with books to sell on commission, or sometimes whole collections. So if word were to get out among other collectors that so-and-so lost a book, they'd be more reluctant to entrust their collections with this dealer. In fact, one dealer told me, once you've been tainted by theft in this business, you're toast. The same is true for rare book librarians. I think it's an embarrassment when they lose a book, which it shouldn't be. I mean, these thieves are sometimes very, very clever, and there's no way that any librarian can be, unless they put every book under lock and key and don't let the public have access, which they don't want to do. Of course, they're occasionally going to be vulnerable. But the idea is, again, I think that these librarians get many of their rare books donated to them, and people with collections to donate certainly don't want to give them to an institution that seems to be lax in their security. So they keep it quiet. In fact, just this year, I think it was maybe 6 months ago, I was talking to a rare book librarian who asked me not to name the library he worked at. And he said when he first started working at this library, somebody came in and asked to see a particular book. He tried to look for it on the shelves. It wasn't there. He looked for it in the archives. It wasn't there. He looked everywhere, and he realized the book had been stolen. But when he approached his boss and explained the situation, she looked at him and she said, "We don't have missing books here, ever." In other words, just that's it. End of story. Do not discuss this with anybody. Now, on the other hand, I've seen signs that things are changing. The British Library just this year decided to go public in a big way, have a big media splash about a theft that they had suffered, a significant one. The thief was caught and sentenced to 2 years in prison. And they said they decided they were not going to keep quiet anymore. They were going to let people know, let thieves know that they were going to take this seriously and they were going to prosecute and they were not going to keep quiet. So this is something that wouldn't have happened a few years ago. So I think it's a positive trend and in the right direction.
All right. We have a caller. We'd welcome others. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-945. Callers in Belgium, Illinois. Line 4 right here. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. Your guest here has just touched on the topic that I wanted to discuss with you all, and that years ago when I was at the university, the original library, you could walk in. This is University of Illinois. You could walk into the library, and there were stacks behind it, but the rare book department or room, whatever you want to call it, was right there, right nearby the door. They always had beautiful books sitting out to look at. Sometimes they were in closed cases, but once you walk through the turnstile, gee, things were pretty wide open. And this is back in the 60s, mind you, okay? And I always thought even then that this is just an accident waiting to happen.
Yes, you're right, and it's security gets tighter and tighter, and in a way it's a sad thing that it's necessary. I know that there have been conferences all over the world in the last few years about just this issue. How do we keep access to these books available for the public, and yet protect the books, you know, from damage or theft. A lot of times the thieves don't take the whole book, but slice maps or illustrations or other special pages out of them. It's a tough issue for librarians.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Again, other questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I think that one thing that might surprise people if they're not involved in this world is what constitutes a rare book. You know, when you say rare book, I think of something like Gutenberg Bible or that book, that German book that you talk about here that got you interested in the story. But in fact, there are a lot of rare books that were, you know, say popular literature published in the 20th century that have significant value. And some of these are the kind of things that Mr. Gilkey was involved in stealing. And I think that some people might actually be surprised at what it is we're talking about.
That's right. You know, I think there are probably about as many definitions of rare as there are collectors out there. And often I would get a cheeky answer when I'd ask somebody, and they'd say, it's a book I want really, really badly, but I can't get my hands on. And as silly as this sounds, it's actually very close to the truth. A rare book is one that's highly desirable among collectors, and even if you have all the money in the world, you can't necessarily get it. There's nothing, it isn't for sale. But one, there are three qualities used to determine the rarity of a book, and those are scarcity, importance, and condition. And that's the same whether you're talking about a 17th century illuminated manuscript or a 20th century book. I'll give you a modern example that everybody's familiar with, and that's Harry Potter. The first edition, the first British edition of Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, the publishers didn't have very high hopes for it. I think they published 500. So there are not very many of them around, and for this reason, first edition, I'm not sure if it needs to be signed or not, but it's worth $30,000 right now.
Wow.
So it depends on how many, you know, scarcity, importance, and condition, again. Another modern first edition that went for a lot of money, and this was just this year, and it's more money than any 20th century book has ever got at auction before. And this was James Joyce's Ulysses. It was sold for £275,000, which is nearly $500,000.
And if the book is signed by the author, does that make a big difference?
It does, and it depends upon how often that, again, it's scarcity, how often that author signed books. There are some authors who never did or very rarely, and there are others who signed, seems, half the copies out there. So that affects the price as well.
I expect that for a lot of the people who collect these books, they are actually too valuable to read so that they don't handle them very much.
You know, the collectors almost never read the books that they collect. I mean, they may read a different edition of it, the paperback or something cheap, but no, they don't want to handle the books very much. It's more about owning this piece of history and something that they care about and keeping it in good shape.
So it's not so much about, they may indeed be readers, but it's not so much about reading. It's not perhaps so much about the what is in the text itself. It is about the physical object.
That's right. And I think it's a really interesting issue right now as we move into e-books more and more, that electronic books are becoming more and more popular. In fact, when I started working on this book, I knew nobody with an electronic book, and now I know several, and many of whom are authors themselves. And what's interesting is that they love the convenience of it, and, you know, how many books they can have with them on this tiny little device. But they also keep buying books. So some books they really want the physical book for. And I think it's a different experience. And that's why we have attachments to books, because we remember holding them. I think there's something different in the physicality of a book. It's more than the content of the what's on the pages that's important.
Yeah, and I suppose it is that keeps people hoping that while more and more people, for the reasons that you cite, for convenience and so forth, might use electronic readers, the hope is that the book as a physical, as a desirable physical object, will not go away.
Yeah, that's certainly what most book lovers I know are hoping. And I don't know if this is true, but somebody once told me that 50% of books sold are sold as for gifts. And I think people, at least that will continue. People would rather give an object that they can sign, you know, happy birthday, leave an inscription and make it a special gift rather than, you know, here's a card that says you just got three books on your reader.
Yeah, I'd like to know how many of those gift books ever get read. Maybe a lot of them do. I don't know. Here's a caller here, someone who's calling on cell phone. So let's go to line one. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to, not to sound cliche, but a book is a present that you can open again and again. And I know that I'm a collector of books, but I strive to read every single one of them, no matter the historical importance or how old the book is or how much it is worth. So I find it interesting that these people collect books, and it's almost like a facade that they put on because these books are on display and they live like vicariously through this stagnance of the books. You know, they're just sitting there. So I find it very interesting that they don't even flip through the pages, you know, because I think I would still want to do that.
Yeah, I think, well, they may flip through them a little, but I think there is a lot of concern about preserving the physical book, I suppose. They also do have a deep reverence for the content, and that's what I think most book collectors started collecting books because they love stories. You know, they loved reading as kids, and every one of them I've met is an avid reader. But it is kind of an odd thing that they don't read them. In fact, the first book fair I went to in New York, I was walking by one dealer who was jokingly calling out to somebody, "Don't judge a book by its content." It was a joke because he specializes in books with really beautiful dust jackets, you know, modern first editions with really beautiful graphics. So I thought that was funny.
Yeah, it is. Well, thanks. I'm enjoying the dialogue here.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Other people who are listening, if you have questions, you're welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. And let me introduce again our guest, Allison Hoover Bartlett. Her writing has appeared in a number of places, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, San Francisco Chronicle Magazine, other publications. She wrote an article that was sort of the basis for this book, an article about the man she has mentioned, the book thief, John Gilkey. This was included in the collection The Best American Crime Reporting 2007, and she has a new book that is almost out, officially will be published on Thursday. The title of her book is The Man Who Loved Books Too Much, The True Story of a Thief, a Detective, and a World of Literary Obsession. Riverhead Books is the publisher. And again, questions welcome. If you'd like to join in the conversation, you can do that. The man that we talked about, you talked a little bit about him, and he's important in the book, John Gilkey. As you explained, he was someone who, unlike a lot of other book thieves, was not stealing the books so he could sell them and make money. He wanted them. Mm-hmm. And presumably the reason that he stole them was that he couldn't actually have afforded to buy these things outright?
That's correct. He could have afforded some of them, but he chose not to pay for them.
You wonder, I suppose, though, whether stealing it was also, there was some sort of excitement associated with stealing it, and for him that might be part of the deal.
That's right. In fact, he told me at one point that he keeps his books that he has stolen in a separate bookcase from those that he has bought, although I don't think he's bought very many. He buys books, I think, at library sales for 50 cents or $2, but the ones that are rare and expensive he keeps separately. So they do take on a special cachet for him if he got away with the theft.
That's almost, it makes it sound like almost like a trophy. You know, like you shoot the
Absolutely.
Animal and you mount the head and you put it on the wall?
Absolutely. In fact, that's the exact metaphor that Ken Sanders, the dealer I mentioned earlier, who had worked as what he called a bibliodick, a book detective, and tracked down Gilkey. That's what he says a lot of people, how some collectors, not the majority, but some collectors approach this pastime is it's like big game hunting. You know, you shoot the animal, put the trophy head on the wall.
Yeah, you met him at a book fair. That is Ken Sanders. You met him at a book fair, and he was the guy that put you on to Gilkey, and he also becomes important to the story too. He's someone who, and maybe understandably, because he's a rare book dealer, and these people do suffer thefts. Was one who became maybe consumed with doing what he could to try to catch people who were stealing books.
That's right. He's been a lover of books his whole life. In fact, he told me his father used to joke that he was born clutching a book. He read everything he could get his hands on as a child and soon began collecting books, I think by the age of 13 or 14. And as he grew older, became an adult, he started dealing in rare books. He's somebody with very strong convictions about what is right and what is wrong, and I think in his mind there's almost nothing worse than somebody who steals books. So he was as obsessed with catching Gilkey as Gilkey was in stealing the books.
Do the people? I would think that the people in the rare book world, that is, the dealers and collectors, would know each other. Are the thieves known? Do people know who they are, or is this a case where, say, if you're a rare book dealer and the thief, a thief walked in your front door, you wouldn't know that person by looking at them that's who they were.
What happens is most of the dealers that I spoke with belong to an organization called the ABAA, the Antiquarian Booksellers Association of America. And I would urge people, if they're considering collecting, to seek out these dealers because they are you can trust them. they're scrutinized very closely before they're allowed to join the organization, and they uphold very strong standards. Ken Sanders was working as the security chair for the organization when he started trying to figure out who Gilkey was and track him down. And as the security chair, what would happen is when a colleague of his would suffer a theft, the colleague would alert Sanders and tell him what the book was and maybe if it had special markings, you know, a tear on page 38 or something like that. Sanders would then immediately email the rest of the trade and sometimes an international organization that was similar, iLab, it's called, and tell them to keep an eye out for this. Because so often what happens is a book thief will go into one dealer, steal a book, walk down the street, go into another one and say, you know, I just inherited this, or I've decided, you know, for whatever reason, I've decided to sell this and make $5,000, $10,000, whatever the book costs. So they are in touch with each other about the thefts, but they don't always know who has stolen them or what the person looks like. Sometimes I know that there was a man in San Francisco hitting a number of stores. This was several years ago. This is not John Gilkey, who would look every bit the gentleman, walk in with a very fine suit on, and I think his story was that he and his wife were separating, and she had this extensive collection that she no longer wanted because he had given her all the books and he was selling them off. So word got out about him, and there was a description of him. So if somebody walked in like that, other dealers would be on alert. But you know, often these book thieves, especially those who've been doing it for a while, are quite clever about how they get around these alerts.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with someone else. We have a caller in Urbana here where we are, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was calling. I've been a collector of banned books, and I was wondering if you could touch on that area and if there's I imagine there's probably thieves who specialize in that, but for a different reason they're stealing them. And I'll turn on my radio and listen.
All right.
Did he say banned?
I assume he meant book that is
books that have been banned.
Books
yes.
that have been not books about bands, but
yes.
books that have been banned.
Yes.
Yes.
That was what I thought. You know, I am not a book expert, and I don't. I think I have not heard of any thieves focusing on banned books. There may be one or two out there, but that's something I guess to talk to a book dealer about. But no, you know, in all the stories I read about book theft, and I think I read just about every one of them that happened in the last several years, I didn't hear of any focusing on that in particular. Now, John Gilkey, he collected collects among a broad range of genre, but the one list that he was following was the Modern Library's list of the 100 best novels in English. So often collectors, not just thieves, but collectors will have a list like this that they follow, like Pulitzer Prize winners or something like that.
Mm-hmm. I suppose that people have interest in books on particular subjects or from particular periods, or I'm sure that there are many different ways to organize a collection or different things that capture the interest of different people. So everyone's thing is probably going to be a little bit different.
That's right. I think there are books about just about any interest or era, as you said. I saw amazing collections of miniature books, for example. These teeny tiny books, one of which was illustrated by Picasso. There were dictionaries the size of one joint of your thumb. There were books, you know, books on natural history, books on cooking, children's books. If you have an interest, a hobby, a period in history that you are fond of, there are a lot of books out there to form a collection around that. And some people are quite creative. There's a man who I interviewed who is putting together a unique collection of books by outsiders. Vagabonds, hobos from the old days, Hell's Angels, hip-hop artists, just people who are maybe not in the mainstream author category.
I'm thinking of there's a somebody says, and now I can't remember who it is, but the line is in the book. Is it somebody says something like, every rare book is a stolen book?
That's right. I heard that right away. Sometimes they were referring to the Romans having pilfered from the Greeks or vice versa, or Queen Christina, when she went through Europe, stole every book she could get her hands on. I guess the idea is that if a book has been around long enough, somewhere in its history there's a theft.
Mm-hmm. I guess the thing that I'm thinking about is the putting yourself in the position of the rare book dealer when the person comes in the door with the book to sell. And I'm sure that establishing provenance can be a difficult thing, and I wonder whether, in a circumstance like that, a dealer always has to entertain the notion that really this might be a stolen book, and you'd have to wonder, where did this book come from, and how did it come into the possession of this person?
Yeah. You know, all the dealers, the ABAA dealers that I spoke with, were very, very diligent about checking the provenance of books. And sometimes you can't. Sometimes the road just ends at some point. But, for example, if there's a library stamp in a book, they will contact the library and make sure that the book wasn't stolen, that it was sometimes books, libraries sell off collections, and that's how people get their hands on them. But they really do try to determine, sometimes, if a dealer, say, gets a book on Jewish history and that's not their specialty, they will contact another dealer who is more familiar with this area and get some help from that person to see if the provenance makes sense, if this really is the chain of ownership. But it can be quite difficult. One thing that Ken Sanders told me that is now becoming more popular because of eBay is that some dealers are offering a certificate of authenticity. And he said that should be just a red flag for anybody collecting. There is no such thing among reputable dealers as a certificate of authenticity because there's guesswork here. it's very, I suppose it can happen for certain books, but it's very rare that you can really authenticate every single sale and purchase of a book from its date of publication in 1655 until today. But because it's become a practice on eBay, people think that that guarantees its authenticity.
Mm-hmm. Somebody like Mr. Gilkey, you'd think, would be actually be positioned to turn himself into a consultant, as I suppose sometimes people who have been criminals have done, have then turned around and sold their services as advisors to people who want to avoid being the subject of that kind of crime. He did, in fact, I think, in a sense, form some kind of relationship with Ken Sanders, although you may also or may want not to talk about where Mr. Gilkey is now and what he's up to.
Well, I think, you know, I think that would be a dream of his come true, to, you know, like the movie and the book Catch Me If You Can. That's what happened. The FBI hired Frank Abagnale, I think is his name, to help them with their work to discover counterfeit checks and so on. I don't think a rare book dealer in this country would work with John Gilkey. They're furious at him for what he's done.
What sort of security do rare book shops have? I would imagine that it's not not at the level, certainly, that, say, rare book libraries would have, although I guess there are some questions about whether, in fact, security there is effective enough. Are a lot of these shops where just people can walk in the door and walk out, and maybe you have one proprietor or a couple people working there, and they have to just keep their eye on the people who are in the store?
That's often the case, although most of the rare book shops I went in had either locked cases or an area that the public could not get to, that was behind a desk, and they would have to ask to see a particular volume for the most valuable of the books. Otherwise, they are on the stacks. They do keep a close eye on people, though, and I think most of them can get a sense for when somebody's acting a little bit shifty. Certainly Ken Sanders has chased a lot of these guys down streets and caught them and got his books back. But it's I think whenever you're selling valuable items, it's security is a challenging issue.
Are dealers collectors themselves? Is that how it is they get in the business?
Yes. Every one of them that I met had either started as a collector or was still a collector. Once they've been dealing for several years, often they stop collecting, but a couple of them told me that buying for the store is a kind of vicarious collecting for them. So they don't really give it up entirely, and occasionally they'll find a book that they really desire and will hunt down. But they start as collectors.
Is it painful for them then to part with books when they're sold?
Well, that's what I ask them, and it's funny. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. Ken Sanders had a collection that he sold when his eldest child went off to college in order to pay for college, and that was hard for him, but he was doing it for a good cause. Other people have told me there was one anecdote that I remember. This dealer was, somebody had asked him, this was on a videotape that had been taken of a rare book fair in San Francisco several years ago. Somebody asked him, do you collect? And this dealer said, no, I don't collect anymore, but sometimes I'll catch a title that I want, and I see it once, and I don't buy it, and then I think about it, I keep obsessing about it, and I have to have it, and I look everywhere for it, and I hunt it down, and I buy it, and then after a couple of days, I can sell it again. It doesn't mean anything to me. So it was very interesting to me because I think it says a lot about the joy of the pursuit, the hunt.
The thrill of the chase.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. And in fact, Freud was a collector, first of books, not in a big way, but as a young man he collected books. Then he focused his collecting ardor on small statues that had been dug up in archaeological sites, which I think was a a wonderful metaphor for what he was doing with people's psyches. But he said of his collecting, I'm something like, I am nothing if not a conquistador. And there's something about that thrill of the hunt that fuels the obsession.
Yeah. We have about maybe 5-6 minutes left in this hour of focus. Our guest is Alison Hoover Bartlett, and we're talking about her new book. It's going to be out officially on Thursday. The Man Who Loved Books Too Much, that's the title. The True Story of a Thief, a Detective, and a World of Literary Obsession. It's published by Riverhead Books, and it is about the people who collect books and the people who sell them, rare books, and sometimes about the people who steal them. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. So I know that you're going out on tour, and I see that you're actually going to be making an appearance at Ken Sanders' shop.
That's right.
In Salt Lake City.
In October.
That should be interesting. It's not often, I suppose, an author gets to do a book talk at the place of someone who is an important character in the book.
I know. I'm honored. I'm going to enjoy it. I visited him while I was working on the book. I spent a few days in Salt Lake City, most of it in his shop, and it's a wonderful store. It's really a cultural high spot of Salt Lake City. There were many artists and filmmakers and writers stopping by when I was there, talking books, and it's a kind of community center there for people who love books. So I'm going to enjoy the visit, I'm sure.
Yeah. Back at the beginning, you explained that you got interested in the subject because somebody that you knew had this book, obviously a very old book, and the story was that it had come out of a library and that person just, they had intended to take it back and never did. So here was this clearly old and clearly valuable book. And you even explained that you got in touch with the library that it was supposed to have come from, and they said, well, we don't have any record of this. So you experienced a little bit of this attraction yourself, and that's what got you into the story. So now, as a result, is there a dimension to your interest in books that you didn't have before?
Well, I think I'm aware of the value of books in a way that I wasn't. I have, you know, it's funny when I think back. I love going to flea markets and garage sales and looking for old items that have some aesthetic charms, but also a history behind them. And often I would pick up books. It had nothing to do with their value, but I remember buying a set of beautiful picture books for my kids when they were small. Several years ago, started buying these little blue books, they're called, which were these little teeny books that would fit in your pocket that were printed. I think they started printing them early 20th century, something like 1918 through 1978. Those dates aren't quite right, but something like that. Anyway, I started picking up those. There are other times when I've bought books at flea markets that were beautiful, and I couldn't resist them. But it wasn't about the monetary value. Now I look for those beautiful things, but I'm also kind of curious about the first editions. I'll check books in a yard sale and see if they're first editions or not. So far I haven't found anything of monetary value, but I continue to pick up just beautiful books.
Well, there are a couple of people who've been listening to our conversation and wanted to know what happened to that book, the Crowder book that you talked about in the beginning. Is it no longer in your possession?
It's no longer in my possession. I finally pulled it out of my hands. As you said, I contacted the library. They said we have no record. In fact, there was a call number on the spine, and I gave it to them, and I described the book, and she looked around in their records for a couple of days and got back to me and said, we have no record of the book. But I learned afterwards that if a book has been missing for several years, often the librarians will just toss the attendant documents because it's probably not coming back, and they don't, again, want to really have records of missing books. But, yes, I did give the book back to my friend.
Oh, okay. So it is now in his possession?
It's in his possession, and he's trying to figure out what to do with it, but I think he's having a difficult time giving it up as well. It has a kind of a spell over people. Yeah.
Well, that's it's understandable just from and as I mentioned at the beginning, if you go to Allison's website, AllisonHooverBartlett.com, you can see the book that we're talking about, and at least you can see a few pages of the book, and I think you can get a sense of what it would be like, and maybe then you can imagine what it would be like to hold it and look at it.
One of the things that so fascinated me was to think that this was published in 1630. As I said, this was when the plague was going through Germany. There were people, you could look up bellyache or hot sweats or whatever and find remedies. And I had a German-speaking friend go through it with me and translate several of the remedies. And I was just amazed. It seemed like this book had had a life of its own with so much history behind it. And I imagined, concerned parents and loved ones poring over this thing by candlelight to try to find cures for their sick family members. And it seemed to have, like I said, a life of its own. And it's amazing that it has survived this long. How many things can survive hundreds of years and really be intact? There were no ripped pages. There were a few pencil marks on the pages from people who've used it, I guess, as a research document. But it's a very impressive piece of literature.
We are coming down to the point here where we're close to our end. We have a minute or two left. We've talked a little bit here about if people want to read more about the main character here, Mr. Gilkey, they're going to have to go out and read the book. And we talked about how when you first started talking with him, he was actually in prison at that point.
Yes.
And that he volunteered to tell you about what he had done.
Mm-hmm.
Where is Mr. Gilkey now?
He is in San Francisco. Over the last year or so, he went back to school. He has a degree in economics, I should say. But he enjoys studying various subjects, business and philosophy and literature. So he's been taking classes, and other than that, I don't know. He does. He works part time occasionally. He doesn't always tell me where, but we are in touch occasionally. He's eager for the book to come out.
And he has. He apparently read the article that I mentioned, the one that was included in the Best American Crime Reporting 2007. But he didn't read a manuscript of Men Who Love Books Too Much.
No, that's right. But he did read the article, which is a story in miniature, and he enjoyed it. So we'll see with the book.
And do you know, has he managed to keep his hands off books that he shouldn't?
I don't think so. I mean, I think he has. I cannot imagine him ever stopping this practice. I can't see into the future, of course, but he said many times that he's wanted to give up books, but in the next sentence he's talking about the next book he'd really love to get his hands on, and he keeps going back to jail. So it seems to be a never-ending story. I think it's like any obsession, it's difficult to tame.
Well, it's a very interesting book. It's a good story. And as I said at the beginning, I think for people who love reading and love books, particularly who love the object of the book, I think that they'll find it very interesting. So I would encourage people to go out and look at the book, The Man Who Loved Books Too Much, The True Story of a Thief, a Detective, and a World of Literary Obsession. The publisher is Riverhead. Comes out officially on Thursday, so you can head down to the bookstore and take a look at it. Our guest, Allison Hoover Bartlett, is the author. Her works appeared in a number of places, New York Times, Washington Post, San Francisco Chronicle Magazine. And Ms. Bartlett, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. We first presented the show in September of 2009. And if you go to her website, you can still see the book that we talk about in this interview. We're sorry that we couldn't do the show that we had scheduled for the first hour, talking with Edward Jaraday about his book Killing the Cranes, about his experiences reporting on Afghanistan. We hope we can get that show rescheduled for another day.
WILL programs are made possible by the University of Illinois School of Music, presenting the Allerton Music Barn Festival, September 1st through 5th at Allerton Park. More information is available at www.allertonmusicbarn.com.
We'll break for an update on the markets. Stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where pretty much all across the grain pits, a lot of green on the screen, although it must be said that prices at this hour are coming back off the highs made earlier in the trading session. Let's go ahead and look at some particulars. In Kansas City, September wheat at 822.5, up 3.5. March, 858, up 5.25. September wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 734.5, up 3.75. March, 793 and